Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
All right, that's fine. All right, we're back on the record. State of Arizona versus Daybell, CR 2021-001704. The parties are present. The jury is not present. We'll bring in the jury. Please be seated. The jury is present. Welcome back, members of the jury. Last Wednesday afternoon, the state rested its case, so now I'll turn to the defendant.
The defense also rests, Your Honor.
All right, at this time, that concludes the evidence portion of the trial. I'm going to have my staff hand out to the jury the final jury instructions. Are we one? We got it. Okay. The jurors have the instructions. Much like the preliminary instructions, you can either follow along with me or just listen. I need to read these into the record. Duty of jury. It is your duty as a juror to decide the case by applying these jury instructions to the facts as you determine them. You must follow these jury instructions. They are the rules you should use to decide this case. It is your duty to determine what the facts are in the case by determining what actually happened. Determine the facts only from the evidence produced in court. When I say evidence, I mean the testimony of witnesses and the exhibits introduced in court. You should not guess about any fact. You must not be influenced by sympathy or prejudice. You must not be concerned with any opinion that you feel I have about the facts. You, as jurors, are the sole judges of what happened. You must consider all these instructions. Do not pick out one instruction or part of one and ignore the others. As you determine the facts, however, you may find that some instructions no longer apply. You must then consider the instructions that do apply together with the facts as you have determined them. Evidence to be considered. You are to determine what the facts in the case are from the evidence produced in court. If the court sustained an objection to a lawyer's question, you must disregard it and any answer given. Any testimony stricken from the court record must not be considered. Rulings of the court. Admission of evidence in court is governed by rules of law. I have applied those rules during the trial and resolved any issues concerning the admission of evidence. If an objection to a question was sustained, you must disregard the question and you must not guess what the answer to the question might have been. If an exhibit was offered into evidence and an objection to it was sustained, you must not consider that exhibit as evidence. If testimony was ordered stricken from the record, you must not consider that testimony for any purpose. If evidence was admitted for a limited purpose, you shall consider that evidence only for that limited purpose. Do not concern yourselves with the reasons for my rulings on the admission of evidence. Do not regard those rulings as any indication from me of the credibility or weight you should give to any evidence that has been admitted. Direct and circumstantial evidence. Evidence may be direct or circumstantial. Direct evidence is the testimony of a witness who saw, heard, or otherwise sensed an event. Circumstantial evidence is the proof of a fact or facts from which you may find another fact. The law makes no distinction between direct and circumstantial evidence. It is for you to determine the importance to be given to the evidence regardless of whether it is direct or circumstantial. redacted exhibits. Some of the exhibits that have been admitted into evidence have had portions deleted from them for legal reasons. Do not concern yourselves with the reasons why some portions of the exhibits have been deleted. Do not speculate upon what the deleted portions might or might not reveal. Indictment is not evidence. The state has charged the defendant with a crime. A charge is not evidence against the defendant. You must not think a defendant is guilty just because of a charge. The defendant has pled not guilty. This plea of not guilty means that the state must prove each element of the charge beyond a reasonable doubt. Self-represented defendant. The defendant in this case represents herself. All instructions I read to you that include references to lawyers or attorneys apply equally to the defendant's self-representation at trial. The defendant's decision to represent herself should not be considered by you when determining the facts. Comments are not evidence. In their opening statements, the prosecutor and the defendant talk to you about the law and the evidence. In a few minutes, the prosecutor and defendant will give their closing arguments and will talk about the law and the evidence. What they said or say is not evidence because it is not sworn testimony, but it may help you to understand the law and the evidence. Credibility of witnesses. In deciding the facts of this case, you should consider what testimony to accept and what to reject. You may accept everything a witness says, or part of it, or none of it. In evaluating testimony, you should use the tests for truthfulness that people use in determining matters of importance in everyday life, including such factors as the witness's ability to see or hear or know the things the witness testified to, the quality of the witness's memory, the witness's manner while testifying, whether the witness had any motive, bias, or prejudice, whether the witness was contradicted by anything the witness said or wrote before trial or by other evidence, and the reasonableness of the witness's testimony when considered in the light of the other evidence. Consider all of the evidence in the light of reason, common sense, and experience. Testimony of law enforcement officers. The testimony of a law enforcement officer is not entitled to any greater or lesser importance or believability merely because of the fact that the witness is a law enforcement officer. You are to consider the testimony of a police officer just as you would the testimony of any other witness. Expert witness. A witness qualified as an expert by education or experience may state opinions on matters in that witness's field of expertise and may also state reasons for those opinions. Expert opinion testimony should be judged just as any other testimony. You are not bound by it. You may accept it or reject it in whole or in part, and you should give it as much credibility and weight as you think it deserves, considering the witness's qualifications and experience, the reasons given for the opinions, and all the other evidence in the case. Defendant need not produce evidence. The state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence. The defendant is not required to produce evidence of any kind. The defendant's decision not to produce evidence is not evidence of guilt. Defendant need not testify. The state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence. You must not conclude that the defendant is likely to be guilty because the defendant did not testify. The defendant is not required to testify. The decision on whether or not to testify is left to the defendant. You must not let this choice affect your deliberations in any way. Mere presence. Guilt cannot be established by the defendant's mere presence at a crime scene, mere association with another person at a crime scene, or mere knowledge that a crime is being committed. The fact that the defendant may have been present or knew that a crime was being committed does not in and of itself make the defendant guilty of the crime charged. One who is merely present is a passive observer who lacked criminal intent and did not participate in the crime. Voluntariness of defendant's statements. You must not consider any statements made by the defendant to a law enforcement officer unless you determine beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant made the statements voluntarily. A defendant's statement was not voluntary if it resulted from the defendant's will being overcome by a law enforcement officer's use of any sort of violence, coercion, or threats, or by any direct or implied promise, however slight. You must give such weight to the defendant's statement as you feel it deserves under all the circumstances. Jury not to consider penalty. You must decide whether a defendant is guilty or not guilty by determining what the facts in the case are and applying these jury instructions. You must not consider the possible punishment when deciding on guilt. Punishment is left to the judge. Presumption of innocence, burden of proof. The law does not require a defendant to prove innocence. Every defendant is presumed by law to be innocent. You must start with the presumption that the defendant is innocent. The state has the burden of proving the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This means the state must prove each element of each charge beyond a reasonable doubt. In civil cases, it is only necessary to prove that a fact is more likely true than not, or that its truth is highly probable. In criminal cases such as this, the state's proof must be more powerful than that. It must be beyond a reasonable doubt. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced of the defendant's guilt. There are very few things in this world that we know with absolute certainty, and in criminal cases, the law does not require proof that overcomes every doubt. If, based on your consideration of the evidence, you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charged, you must find her guilty. If, on the other hand, you think there is a real possibility that she is not guilty, you must give her the benefit of the doubt and find her not guilty. Evidence of any kind. The state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt on the evidence. The defendant is not required to produce evidence of any kind. The decision on whether to produce evidence is left to the defendant. The defendant's decision not to produce any evidence is not evidence of guilt. Voluntary act. Before you may convict the defendant of the charged crime, you must find that the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed a voluntary act. A voluntary act means a bodily movement performed consciously and as a result of effort and determination. You must consider all the evidence in deciding whether the defendant committed the act voluntarily. Absence of other participant. The only matter for you to determine is whether the state has proved the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant's guilt or innocence is not affected by the fact that that another person or persons might have participated or cooperated in the crime and is not on trial now. You should not guess about the reason any other person is absent from the courtroom. Motive. The state need not prove motive, but you may consider motive or lack of motive in reaching your verdict. The charged offense. I will now tell you about the crime with which the defendant is charged. Count one, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. The crime of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder requires proof that the defendant, on or about July 11, 2019, with the intent to promote or aid in the commission of first-degree murder, agreed with Alexander Cox that at least one of them or another would engage in conduct constituting the offense of first-degree murder. The crime of first-degree premeditated murder requires proof that a person, one, caused the death of another person, and two, intended or knew that he or she would cause the death of another person, and three, acted with premeditation. Premeditation means that the defendant intended to kill another human being or knew she or a co-conspirator would kill another human being, and that after forming that intent or knowledge, reflected on the decision before killing. It is this reflection, regardless of the length of time in which it occurs, that distinguishes first-degree murder from second-degree murder. An act is not done with premeditation if it is the instant effect of a sudden quarrel or heat of passion. The time needed for reflection is not necessarily prolonged, and the space of time between the intent or knowledge to kill and the act of killing may be very short. Elements of conspiracy. The crime of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder requires proof, one, the defendant agreed with one or more persons that one of them or another person would engage in certain conduct, and two, the defendant intended to promote or assist in the commission of such conduct, and three, the intended conduct would constitute the crime of first-degree murder, and the defendant knew that such conduct was a crime. Scope of proof of conspiracy. To prove a conspiracy, it is not necessary to show a formal meeting or an express agreement. A conspiracy may be inferred from circumstances showing a common criminal objective and does not require proof that all means set forth in the charging document were agreed upon or actually used, nor that every person involved was a member of the conspiracy. Proof of membership in conspiracy. One may become a member of a conspiracy without full knowledge of all the details of the conspiracy. On the other hand, a person who has no knowledge of a conspiracy but happens to act in a way that furthers some object of the conspiracy does not thereby become a conspirator. Before you find that a defendant or any other person was a member of a conspiracy, the evidence must show beyond a reasonable doubt that the conspiracy was knowingly formed and that the defendant or another person knowingly participated in the unlawful plan with the intent to promote or assist the carrying out of the conspiracy. One who knowingly joins an existing conspiracy is as responsible as an originator or instigator of the conspiracy. A person understanding the unlawful character of a plan who knowingly encourages, advises, or assists in the undertaking thereby also becomes a conspirator. In determining whether a conspiracy exists, you should consider the actions and statements of all the alleged participants. However, in determining whether a particular defendant was a member of the conspiracy, you should consider only that person's acts and statements. A person cannot be bound by the acts or statements of other participants until it is established that a conspiracy existed and that person was one of its members. Justification for self-defense physical force. A person is justified in using or threatening deadly physical force in self-defense if the following two conditions existed. One, a reasonable person in the situation would have believed that deadly physical force was immediately necessary to protect against another's use or apparent attempted or threatened use of unlawful deadly physical force. And two, the person used or threatened no more deadly physical force than would have appeared necessary to a reasonable person in the situation. A person may use deadly physical force in self-defense only to protect against another's use or apparent attempted or threatened use of deadly physical force. Self-defense justifies the use or threat of deadly physical force only while the apparent danger continues, and it ends when the apparent danger ends. The force used may not be greater than reasonably necessary to defend against the apparent danger. The use of deadly physical force is justified if a reasonable person in the situation would have reasonably believed that immediate deadly physical danger appeared to be present. Actual danger is not necessary to justify the use of deadly physical force in self-defense. You must decide whether a reasonable person in a similar situation would believe that deadly physical force was immediately necessary to protect against another's use, attempted use, threatened use, apparent attempted use, apparent threatened use of unlawful deadly physical force. You must measure the person's belief against what a reasonable person in the situation would have believed. A person has no duty to retreat before threatening or using deadly physical force in self-defense if the person, one, had a legal right to be in the place where the use or threatened deadly physical force in self-defense occurred, and two, was not engaged in any unlawful act at the time when the use or threatened deadly physical force in self-defense occurred. If evidence was presented that raised this justification defense for count one, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, then the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant or co-conspirator did not act with such justification. If the state fails to carry this burden, then you must find the defendant not guilty of the charge. Justification for defense of a third person. A person is justified in using or threatening physical force in defense of a third person if the following two conditions existed. One, a reasonable person in the situation would have believed that physical force was necessary to protect against another's use, attempted use, apparent attempted use, threatened use of unlawful physical force against a third person. And two, the defendant used or threatened no more physical force than would have appeared necessary to a reasonable person in the situation. A defendant may use deadly physical force in defense of a third person only to protect against another's use, attempted use, apparent attempted use, threatened use of deadly physical force. Defense of a third person justifies the use of or threat of physical force or deadly physical force only while the danger continues, and it ends when the danger ends. The force used may not be greater than reasonably necessary to defend against the danger. Actual danger is not necessary to justify the use of physical force or deadly physical force in defense of a third person. The use of physical force or deadly physical force is justified if a reasonable person in the situation would have reasonably believed that immediate physical danger appeared to be present. You must decide whether a reasonable person in a similar situation would believe that, one, physical force was necessary to protect against another's use, attempted use, apparent attempted use, threatened use of unlawful physical force against a third person, and or two, deadly physical force was necessary to protect against another's use, attempted use, apparent attempted use, threatened use of unlawful physical force against a third person. You must measure the person's belief against what a reasonable person in the situation would have believed. The state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the person did not act with such justification. If the state fails to carry this burden, then you must find the defendant not guilty of the charge. Use of force in crime prevention. A person was justified in threatening or using physical force and/or deadly physical force against another if and to the extent the person reasonably believed that physical force or deadly physical force was immediately necessary to prevent another from committing or apparently committing the crime of aggravated assault. There is no duty to retreat before threatening or using deadly physical force. There is no requirement that any threat to the person's safety exists before the person may use physical force and/or deadly physical force. However, physical force and/or deadly physical force can be used only to the extent it appears reasonably and immediately necessary to prevent commission of the crime of aggravated assault. The person's use or threatened use of physical or deadly force is not limited to a person's home, residence, place of business, land the person owns or leases, or conveyance of any kind, but includes any place in this state where a person has a right to be. The person is presumed to have acted reasonably if the defendant reasonably believed he or she was acting to prevent the imminent or actual commission of aggravated assault. The person is justified in using physical force and/or deadly physical force against another person, even if that person is not actually committing or attempting to commit the crime, if the person reasonably believed he or she was preventing the commission of the crime. Actual danger is not necessary to justify the use of physical force or deadly physical force in crime prevention. If evidence was presented that raised this justification defense for first-degree murder, then the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the person did not act with such justification. If the state fails to carry this burden, then you must find the defendant not guilty of the charge. Non-justification for threat or use of physical force. A person is not justified in using or threatening physical force against another in response to verbal provocation alone, or if the defendant or co-conspirator provoked the other person's use or attempted use of unlawful physical force, unless 1, the defendant or co-conspirator withdrew from the encounter or clearly communicated to the other person the intent to withdraw with the reasonable belief that the defendant could not safely withdraw, and 2, the other person continued or attempted to use unlawful physical force against the defendant or co-conspirator. The state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant and or co-conspirator did not act with such justification. If the state fails to carry this burden, then you must find the defendant not guilty of the charge. Definitions. Intentionally or with the intent to means that a person's objective is to cause that result or to engage in that conduct. Intent may be inferred from all the facts and circumstances disclosed by the evidence. It need not be established exclusively by direct sensory proof. The existence of intent is one of the questions of fact for your determination. Knowingly, willfully, or new means that a person is aware or believes that his or her conduct is of that nature or that the circumstance exists. It does not require any knowledge of the unlawfulness of the act or omission. If the state is required to prove that the defendant acted knowingly, that requirement is satisfied if the state proves that the defendant acted intentionally. A defendant is criminally accountable for the conduct of another if the defendant is an accomplice of such other person in the commission of the offense, including any offense that is a natural and probable or reasonably foreseeable consequence of the offense for which the person was an accomplice. Accomplice means a person who, with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense, does any of the following. 1, solicits or commands another person to commit the offense, or 2, aids, counsels, agrees to aid, or attempts to aid another person in planning or committing the offense, or 3, provides means or opportunity to another person to commit the offense. Act means a bodily movement. Aggravated assault means a person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly caused a physical injury to another person or intentionally put another person in reasonable apprehension of imminent physical injury by either 1, causing serious physical injury to another person, or 2, using a deadly weapon or dangerous instrument. Conduct means an act or omission and its accompanying culpable mental state. Deadly weapon means anything designed for lethal use, including a firearm. Dangerous instrument means anything that is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used. Deadly physical force means either one, force which is used with the purpose of causing death or serious physical injury, or two, force which in the manner of its use is capable of creating a substantial risk of causing death or serious physical injury. Unlawful means contrary to law or, where the context so requires, not permitted by law. Jury foreperson, the case will soon be submitted to you for your decision. When you go to the jury room, you will choose a foreperson. The role of jury foreperson is important, but please remember that the foreperson's opinion about the case is not more important than that of the other jurors. The opinions of each juror count equally. The jury foreperson's responsibilities include the following. One, make sure every member of the jury is present during all discussions and deliberations. Two, make sure that the deliberations are conducted respectfully and that all issues are fully discussed. The discussions should be open and free so that every juror may participate. Three, all jurors should be allowed to state their views about the case and what they think the verdict should be and why. Four, all members must agree unanimously on any verdict. Therefore, the foreperson should count the votes to ensure that every juror has voted. Five, if you reach a verdict, fill out the verdict form and then sign the form on behalf of the jury. Six, if the jury reaches a verdict, the foreperson will inform the courtroom assistant. When the jury returns to the courtroom, the foreperson will bring the signed or unsigned verdict form as well as any question forms that may have been used. Seven, when you return to the courtroom, the court will ask the foreperson whether the jury has reached any verdict. The foreperson will respond yes or no. The foreperson is not expected to read any verdict to the court. That will be done by the clerk. Closing instruction. In a few minutes, we're probably going to take a lunch break, and then after the lunch break, you will hear the closing arguments in this case. After that, the case will be submitted to you for decision. I suggest that you discuss and then set your deliberation schedule. You are in charge of your schedule and may set and vary it by agreement and the approval of the court. After you have decided on a schedule, please advise the courtroom assistant. You are to discuss the case and deliberate only when all jurors are together in the jury room. You are not to discuss the case with each other or anyone else during breaks or recesses. The admonition I have given you during the trial remains in effect when all of you are not in the jury room deliberating. After setting your schedule, I suggest that you next review the jury instructions and verdict form. It may be helpful for you to discuss the instructions and verdict form to make sure that you understand them. Again, during your deliberations, you must follow the instructions and refer to them to answer any questions about applicable law, procedure, and definitions. Should any of you or the jury as a whole have a question for me during your deliberations or wish to communicate with me on any other matter, please utilize the jury question form that we will provide you. Your question or message must be communicated to me in writing and must be signed by you or the foreperson. I will consider your question or note and consult with counsel before answering it in writing. I will answer it as quickly as possible. Remember that you are not to tell anyone, including me, how you stand numerically or otherwise until after you have reached a verdict or have been discharged. During your deliberations, you must not communicate with or provide any information to anyone by any means about this case. You may not use any electronic device or social media to communicate to anyone any information about this case or to conduct any research about this case until I accept your verdict. All 12 of you must agree on the verdict. You must be unanimous. Once all 12 agree on a verdict, only the foreperson need sign the verdict form on the line marked jury foreperson. You will be given one form of verdict. The verdict form reads as follows, and there is no significance to the order in which the options of guilty or not guilty are listed on the verdict form. So this is a sample verdict form at the end of your instructions. It indicates this is a sample. An official verdict form will be given to you by the courtroom assistant in the jury room. Verdict count one, conspiracy to commit first degree murder. We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn in the above entitled action and upon our oaths, do find the defendant, Lori Daybell, as to the crime of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder occurring on or about July 11, 2019, as follows. Check only one, and the options are not guilty or guilty. In order to break up the closing arguments as little as possible, we're going to take our lunch recess a little early and start a little early with those closing arguments after you recess. So we'll go ahead and recess for your lunch break. If we could have everyone ready to go in the jury room at 12:45, please remember the admonition.
All rise for the jury.
I'll have the parties back in the courtroom at around 12:40-ish. And my staff will be here if you need any exhibits that you anticipate needing for closing arguments, or you want to double check any media that you might need is working at that time. All right, anything else from the state? Defense?
Your Honor, can I move for Exhibit 20 to be admitted for appellate purposes?
Is that your full interview?
Yes.
Sorry.
Any objection?
For appellate purposes.
All right, Exhibit 20 would be admitted for appeal purposes. It won't be given to the jury during deliberations. Are you sure it's 20? It's for exhibit.
It is.
Defense
20? Defense 20.
No, it's defense 20.
It's defense.
Well, it got numbered.
Yeah, numbered them different ways. It's going to be 200 and something.
Okay, give me a second. I'll figure that out.
Or your...
And it, should we put it on a CD?
Anywhere from 256 to 272. You'll have to figure out which one it is. But we can clarify that. Might have to look at the actual exhibits to determine which one it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to ask that you take all of your belongings with you for lunch.
Anything else?
That's all, Your Honor.
So,
remind me to clarify which one it is when we get back from lunch. But your staff can look at the, or your team can look at the exhibits. All right, we'll go on the record. State of Arizona versus Lori Daybell, CR 2021-001704. Before our break this morning, the defendant moved to have an exhibit admitted for appeal purposes only. That exhibit number, the correct number, I believe, is 269.
That's what I understand, Your Honor.
All right, so it's ordered that 269 would be admitted for appeal purposes. It won't go back to the jury during their deliberations. Go ahead and get the jury lined up, I guess. All right, the jury is now present. Please be seated. This is time set for closing arguments. The state can proceed with its closing argument.
July 18th of 2019, just 7 days after this defendant and her co-conspirator, Alex Cox, shot and killed Charles. This defendant texted her soon-to-be next husband, Chad Daybell, about Charles's life insurance policy. Her words tell us that she was involved in this killing. Her actions and her words of texting Chad Daybell tell us the motives behind this murder. Chad and money. The morning of that 18th of July, Lori Vallow texted Chad and said, quote, "I just got the letter from the insurance company saying that I am not the beneficiary. It's a spear through my heart. Who do you think he changed it to?" Later that day, after she spoke with the life insurance company, she sent Chad another text. Quote, "So I talked to the insurance company. He changed it in March. Probably it was Ned before we got rid of him." Lori Vallow's words 7 days after Charles was shot and killed tells us that "we" was her and Alex killing Charles. Why? For that money. But Lori Vallow's plan to kill Charles wasn't just known by her lover, Chad Daybell, and her accomplice and co-conspirator, Alex Cox. It was also known by her brother, Adam. Adam told us that he knew about Lori's beliefs. He knew what she had been saying about Charles, about Charles's concerns for himself. And he told us that he knew about this plan for an intervention to talk to a stakeholder. That morning of July 11th, when Charles arrived at Lori's house, as she knew he would, he texted Adam and said, "Alice here." Adam texted back, "They are planning something." He knew. And 3 days later on Saturday, when Adam finally learned, when his friend Googled Charles, that he had been shot and killed by Alex, Adam told us he went back and talked to his mother and he confronted her about this. And he told his mother, "Lori and Alex conspired to kill Charles." He knew, and he was right. Lori's ex-friend, Christina Atwood, she told you about that very uncomfortable dinner on June 9th, a month before the murder, where Alex Cox was talking about just wanting to kill Charles. He said this multiple times, and this defendant didn't care. In fact, she talked about how she had been drugging Charles. Christina told you she was so disturbed by this, she actually went and saw Lori the next day, June 10th, and told her, "If something happens to Charles, I'm going to have to go to the police." Christina knew. She was right. And Nancy Jo Hancock, now she had just met Charles a few days before, and they had talked and texted and had been on the phone for hours, you heard. Charles had told her all about Lori, the things she was saying, the things she was doing. She told you that she knew that Charles was concerned for his own safety. And she understood the motive. She told Charles the night before, "You probably should just tell Lori that you've changed the beneficiary, that she's no longer going to get that money." Nancy Jo knew, and she was right. Lori Vallow wanted the $1 million, and she wanted Chad Daybell. And she and Alex used that twisted religious beliefs they had so that they could kill the evil possessed Charles and be like Nephi. The evidence that has been presented in this trial will prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant is guilty of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. So I want to split up my closing into three sections. First, I'm going to talk to you about the timeline and the motives in this case and the evidence that supports those. Second, I want to talk to you about the jury instructions and the evidence that's been presented to you in court. I'll remind you that anything the defendant said in her opening was not presented at trial through a witness or through an exhibit, and it is not evidence. Using the evidence that has been presented and admitted at trial, the state will show you how, again, the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of this crime. And finally, I'm going to talk to you about those justification defenses, the excuses and the reasons why the defendant would like you to believe that they had a valid basis for shooting and killing Charles on July 11th. And we'll talk about how, in fact, there is no justification for what they happened. What happened that morning was a first-degree premeditated execution of Charles Vallow. So let's go through the evidence. The timeline really starts, and we know it goes back much further than this, but the big change occurs on June 29th or 30th, when you learned that Charles Vallow learned about these K.K. Walker emails. He learned about that affair with Chad. Now he knows Lori is cheating on him. We know that he contacted Chad Daybell about it. He contacted Chad's wife about this. He told Adam about it, and he told the defendant about it. So everyone knew that Charles now knew this. July 9th is now the first time that Charles is going to be coming back to Arizona. We know from the time he learned about that affair, he hadn't been back until this planned visit to see his son, JJ. We know at 1:13 p.m., Charles texts Adam and books him a flight for the next day. At 1:21, we know that Adam is contacting Alex, and they talk for 20 minutes, and Alex lets Adam know, sure, you can stay with me. Of course, Alex has now doesn't know the plan yet, the mission. Lori then starts talking to Chad Daybell. We know that she knows about this intervention. She knows about Adam coming, and we know this because, again, of her text messages. We see Lori then starting to round up the troops. Why does she do this? Because she wants to ensure that on July 11th, it is Charles and only Charles coming to the house and not the intervention of Adam or Brandon or Zach coming over to help him. So she has Melanie, tells her she can't go to this wedding. She has to stay here. It's coming to a head. This week will change everything. Call me. Then we have July 9th, the text messages with Alex. She tells him, so the plot thickens, call me when you can. He doesn't call her initially. So she sends him another message, this one really letting him know. She specifically tells him, I'm going to need you to stay close to me the next couple days. Mel too, she can't go to Utah. She's got a job. They are planning some kind of intervention, but want Mel out of the way, so I'm left alone. She talks, I need to come get the stuff at your house tomorrow and secure it. Lots to do. Thank you for standing by me. It's all coming to a head this week. I will be like Nephi, I am told, and so will you. And then what happens? This gets Alex to call, and they talk for almost an hour planning how they're going to stop the intervention, how they're going to be like Nephi. As we get to the 10th of July, and we continue through this timeline, we see Lori again talking religiously with Chad, 149 minutes that morning. She's also texting Lori, or texting Melanie Boudreau, Melanie B, telling her that it's important for the mission the mission for Melanie to help her by keeping Brandon distracted. We saw those messages where Melanie says she'll pretend to be sick. We know that on the 10th, Adam arrives in Phoenix. And now we have Summer helping the defendant, letting her know what is going on with Adam and Zach. Everyone is covered to ensure that Charles will be alone on the 11th. We have the continuing talks with Chad, her soon-to-be husband. As we get into the 10th in the afternoon, we know that per their agreement, Adam calls his brother Alex. Hey, I'm here. Brother doesn't answer. He sends him a text. I'm here. No response. Why? Because the night before, his sister Lori told him, we have a mission. We must be like Nephi. Charles is coming into town. You must stay at my house the night of the 10th so you can be here the morning of the 11th. We also know that Summer gave Lori an out. Hey, you can stay at my house. No one will know where you are. We're going to be out of town. You can hang out here. Lori doesn't take her up on that. She has a mission to do. As the night grows on the 10th, Adam continues to try to reach his brother Alex. Again, no response. And by 45 or so minutes after that last text by Adam, we know Alex is already at Lori's house. He's there with his gun and a garbage bag of some underwear. Why? That gun is important. A loaded weapon, two extra magazines of ammunition with him. He is ready for his mission. And again, Summer is updating her, telling Lori that Zach and Adam are still at her house. They're going to go stay at Mimi's. And she even tells him that Adam is still waiting for Alex to get back to him. Still, he doesn't understand. Why isn't my brother responding to me? I was supposed to stay there. And again, what does Adam bring over? Gun and a garbage bag of clothes. That's all he needs to be part of the mission. When we get to July 11th, we still have Lori talking with Chad. We see those text messages going back between them. And then we start learning from the GPS from Charles Vallow's phone as he arrives. 7:35 a.m., he arrives at 5531 South Four Peaks. That's where we have, at 7:36, Adam texting Charles. They are planning something. There is no reason why Alex should be there. And that explains why Alex wasn't responding to me and didn't let me stay there. We see that last outgoing text message by Charles Vallow at 7:37. And in fact, what we see is at 7:37 and 12 seconds, Charles sends out his last outgoing message. And at 7:37 and 29 seconds, there's an incoming message from Adam. It's not read until 12:13 p.m. What becomes important here is, in this timeline, how long is Charles at the residence here? You hear in her interview how she says it's so fast. Charles comes inside. He's angry. He's jerky. And she tells him, take JJ. Go get him Burger King. They get JJ out to the car. And then she holds onto the phone. And this argument erupts, and it's just so fast. But what we know is it's actually 12 minutes long. This is not a fast incident. In this 12 minutes, Lori Vallow and her brother Alex Cox are doing their mission, and they are being like Nephi. We know at 7:49, it's over. Lori has left
in Charles Vallow's car with his phone and JJ and Tylee. We know that there are two phone calls between Alex and this defendant after she leaves. As Charles is laying dying or dead on the floor, 7:52, 8:06, they talk. 47 minutes passes before Alex calls 911. 47 minutes to stage the scene. The police are advised when they arrive that the shooting just occurred and that CPR was given. Why is that important? Because you heard even during the interviews, the police were trying to figure out this timeline didn't make sense. At 8:48, almost an hour later, Lori Vallow returns. And then we see that around 9:40, she is being interviewed at the Family Advocacy Center. We know that Lori Vallow has Charles's phone that entire afternoon. You saw the PowerPoint from Detective Werther showing that her phone by about 12:36 is already her phone, Alex's phone, and Charles's phone are all in the area of Alex's house out in Sandham. You see on her records that she, again, calls Chad Daybell. We see that Detective Enclan calls her and leaves her a message. They don't leave immediately because what do we know? We know at 2:13, Alex is taking photos of Adam's or flight reservations from Charles's phone. Not screenshots, but photos of the phone. At 2:18, Lori Vallow, who has not told Charles's kids, his family, about his murder, is calling the mortuary. A little bit after that, they still haven't left. She's calling Chad again. And then by 3:11, we know that Charles's phone, through the GPS data, is back at 5531 South Four Peaks. And when asked about it, the defendant and Tylee hand it over and provide the PIN. They have no problem on how to get into it. They've already looked through it. They don't need it anymore. That evening, Lori and Chad are talking all night. You can look through the exhibits and see the multiple calls of them discussing. These aren't calls to Charles's family. They're not calls to his kids. They're talking with her lover, her soon-to-be husband, Chad Daybell. So let's talk about the motives of this case. Money. We see that from the text messages and the anger that you see through them when she learns that that's been changed and she's not going to get it. Chad Daybell. We didn't go through those text messages, but you can look at them. They are already very romantically involved by the time that Charles is murdered. And it's clear that Chad knows exactly what's going on because he's asking her about the car, about the insurance. All of those things Chad knows. And then there's that religious belief system. The zombies, the Z's, the possessed evil spirits. And her being like Nephi. All a reason and a way to kill someone, just like Nephi, a justified killing. There's that first call when we talk about money motive to Banner Life Insurance.
And what was the cause of his passing?
Well, he was shot.
Okay.
So I don't know how I want to put that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I hate to ask, but is it, you can just say yes or no. Was it a homicide?
No, it was an accident.
An accident.
So what we hear here is Lori Vallow being untruthful to Banner Life Insurance.
We'll talk about credibility later, but it becomes very relevant that even in the smallest of things, this defendant exaggerates, minimizes, and is completely untruthful to various people. We all know that she was not the beneficiary. She didn't. But we also know that Charles Vallow was not accidentally shot. She told the police she was there. She knows that her brother intentionally shot him. Of course, they want to claim it's self-defense. There's no accident about that when you shoot someone twice. Motives for money. What we see again here is Lori Vallow talking to Thad about the motive. Telling Chad about the fact that it was changed. I just got the letter from that insurance company saying I am not the beneficiary. It is a spear through my heart. Who do you think he changed it to? Brandon, or probably Kay? He left nothing for JJ. What do we know? Again, we see that Chad knows about all of these things. And what does he talk about in that morning as you have those entire messages in Exhibit 230? It would be interesting if he got changed after he had two bullets to the chest. Again, as we talk about the murder we have later in that day, the message that I talked to you about. So it was probably Ned before we got rid of him. We, not I, not my brother Alex, but we did. And then the other thing in this text message that is of importance is the fact that Lori Vallow knew a month before she went to Social Security how much money she was already going to get for the death of Charles. Here she says, I will still get the $4,000 a month from Social Security. When we talk about that motive and the anger by this defendant over not being the beneficiary, we know that even on July 28th, 10 days later, she goes into Charles's computer to find the change of beneficiary form. She texts that to Chad to show him, and she sends it to Kay and confronts her about it. Money. That's what she wanted. And Chad. So let's talk about Chad. The affair with Chad Daybell. We know that she knew him as far back as November of 2018 when she came here, when he came to Arizona and stayed at Lori's house. You were told by Detective Duncan that there were recordings on her Lori for Style iCloud account of Chad Daybell here in Arizona for that Preparing the People conference. You also heard that in the Lolly Time, the later account that was created later, that in March of 2019, there were screenshots of flights to Idaho and back to Arizona with both Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. This is during that time when she disappeared and Charles was taking care of JJ and she's off flying to Hawaii and Idaho, living the good life with her soon to be husband. And then of course we know that come November 5th, she actually marries Chad Daybell. That KK Walker email address. This was that June 29th. Big change. What do we know? That on April 21st, she created that account. She used her own phone number in creating it. And then she sent messages to Chad Daybell, Brother Daybell. You have that exhibit. She pretends to be Karen Walker and invites him to Houston, because that's where she is at that time. She offers to use Charles's money to fly him out there and that he can stay at the house with her and her husband. In June of 2019, we see that Lori again uses that same account, but this time she pretends to be Charles, and invites Chad out to Arizona to help him with a book. And again, in Exhibit 289, you have those letters. Charles finds those.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.